This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
To tell you the truth, I didn't think the name Superstorm Sandy would stick, but it has. And as the areas that were affected by Sandy continue to rebuild, there is another consequence of the storm literally growing under people's noses. Mold.
Mold are natural things. Mold is everywhere.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to an expert in environmental medicine about what's being called Sandy's second wave.
We'll also talk about the changes to the Health Insurance Portability, Privacy, and Accountability Act. You know them as the HIPAA rules. And we'll hear how the Affordable Care Act may mean access to health insurance for many Native Americans. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. The damage from Hurricane Sandy made for some stark pictures on TV. But for people in the middle of the storm, it was more than scary pictures. It was a life-altering event. Now, as the affected regions continue to rebuild, health officials are worried about a second wave of damage from Sandy. Mold. Every saturated wall and damp 2x4 can be an incubator for mold, and there's limited help from insurance companies for cleanup. Here to talk about the potential health hazards of mold is Dr. Eckert Johanning, an occupational and environmental physician practicing in New York City and in the state's capital region. He's also the medical director of the nonprofit Fungal Research Foundation. Dr. Johanning, how potentially widespread can this problem be?
Mold are natural things. Mold is everywhere. But some mold, when they get to certain materials with the right temperature, the right moisture and dampness, start to grow. And with the growing, sometimes we get some molds that are not so good, that are not normally in the outdoor air that we're used to, we're somewhat adapted to. There are molds, what we call water-prone, and you know, some people know them as black molds, or some people refer to them as toxic molds. But it grows on cellulose material, wood, sheetrock, furniture, books, the things that we have indoors.
And these different types of molds, they affect different people in different ways. Like there are some, like you said, we're used to, we just live with them every day, but it's those unusual ones that really get people.
Right. And we actually call them atypical molds because they're not commonly found in our environment, indoors or outdoors, and also in very high quantities. And I think that's important for the listener to know. We're really talking not about the small little mounds that you may find in the shower curtain or between the tiles in the bathroom. Now, that's not what we're concerned about. We're concerned about large scale, several square foot of mold contamination that then can release spores, gases that commonly are referred to as mildew smell that can become airborne, and then people inhale it, and typically the nose or the lungs are then where it settles, and people will have symptoms.
Do these molds affect everybody or just people who are, say, allergic to them?
Well, that's an interesting question, and a lot of people are researching this now. What molds are doing what? But we got to break this down. Now, there are three health categories that we are concerned about. One is infection, which is typically rare with these indoor settings. The other is allergies. And probably people who are prone to allergies will react more to indoor mold. And then the third category of health reactions is irritant reactions. Now, some of these molds make byproducts, and I always say it's like a cocktail. It's not one mold or the other and one byproduct. It's some of all these things. And some of these have more of these irritant toxic properties and then cause irritation to the skin, the nose, the eyes, and also in the lungs where you get a cough reaction, bronchitis. So people who are allergic are the ones who probably will react to it at small amounts. They don't need much once they're sensitized to this. The people who react to the toxic or irritant properties probably need more of it. And typically it's people who do cleanup unprotected, who are in rooms that have several square feet of these mold contamination, and people are not protected with respirators. So again, infection, allergy, and toxic irritant reactions are the three categories that a doctor would try to distinguish.
Looking at the homes down in the affected area, it must be obvious where the mold is in those homes. Like you say, some of those rooms have big, you know, several foot wide swaths of mold in them. How about just a normal home in a regular area that hasn't been hit? How do you know if you have a mold problem? Are there telltale signs?
Yeah. Like I said, mold is everywhere to a certain amount, and we're not worried about this. We're worried about when people see the mold, you smell it, and key element to mold indicators is flooding, water damage, dampness that lasts for a day or two or more in an interior setting. Now, that's prone to mold growth, and it can be between the walls. It can be behind wallpaper, vinyl wallpaper, for instance. On the outside, it looks okay. Behind it, it's full of mold. Can be between sheetrock, can be under carpet or flooring, can be in the basement under crawl space. But again, you would smell it, and if you investigate it, and I always recommend doing this, you know, with protection when you start looking for that and you open up things, you know, with a respirator. But then you see it, and this is where things can get critical, especially now with spring coming. Mold is a natural product, so it needs certain temperature and nutrients, and they're coming. You know, once it's cold and dry, mold doesn't proliferate. It doesn't smell as much and doesn't go in the air as much.
We all have control over our own homes to some extent, but some people's workplaces or schools might be affected by this. How does one go about trying to live with that situation?
Well, in schools and public buildings, it can be more complicated because you have ventilation system in these buildings often, and you don't see where the mold is or the source of the mold, but you may get air that's contaminated. And again, there's some telltale signs, you know. One is the odor, like I said, and then certain symptoms that people can report once they get into a certain room. What they should do is certainly alert the building managers, custodian, or air quality people about it. And these people then need to look behind ceiling tiles. They have to investigate the HVAC system, look at the filters, make sure the filters are clean and not contaminated. No, so that takes a professional approach. But I can tell you, I mean, schools are much more aware of these problems now. So if teachers or students complain about asthma or sinus problems and they go to the doctor and the doctor says, yeah, maybe it's your workplace where you may be exposed to things that you don't see, now go get someone to check it out, and people know how to identify it and correct it.
If you find some in your home, is this something that you should tackle yourself with a bottle of bleach and a mask, or is it better left to the professionals?
Well, it depends on the extent, like we said before. I mean, the good news is I started doing this 20 or 30 years ago, looking at these problems. There was hardly any information around. Nowadays, if you look now things up on the internet, you find a lot of advice there and a lot of professional offers. Small amounts, certainly you can clean up yourself. And again, there are guidelines on it, EPA. If you look that up on the internet, and there's a website just for mold and specifically how to clean it up properly. Small amounts you can do yourself. Larger scale, I would really consult with a professional. And we typically recommend to get an industrial hygienist, preferably a certified industrial hygienist, to scope the problem, write a spec plan, specification plan, how it should be done, and then hire a remediation company to clean it up, get rid of all visible mold with safety margins. And I should note, we don't recommend using biocides necessarily. In most cases, especially where animals and people go back in and live, because biocides can be a problem. The other thing I want to note too, I said using bleach for cleanup. Now, bleach has its own little concerns and dangers. It should be done with proper protection, eye protection, so on and so forth. Another good guideline, and that's based on work that I was directly involved in New York City 20 years ago. The New York City Department of Health, on their website, has a guideline for the assessment and remediation of mold. It's free. Now, and that details now what do you do at what level of mold contamination, where you as a homeowner can do your own approach and where you should consult with a professional and you probably need help.
Dr. Ecker Johanning is an occupational and environmental physician practicing in New York City and in New York's capital region. For more information, you can go to epa.gov/mold or go to nyhealth.gov and search that site for mold.
Still to come, you know those HIPAA forms you get at the doctor's office? Well, you'll be getting a new one soon with significant changes. We'll explain next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1302.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm sure most of us have done this at least once. You go to the doctor's office and they hand you this form called the HIPAA Privacy Rules and ask you to carefully read and then sign the form. 30 seconds later, with glazed eyes, you just sign it and hand it right back in. But there is important information on that form. The rules require appropriate safeguards to protect the privacy of personal health information and sets limits and conditions on how that information can be used and be disclosed without your authorization. And now there are important additions to those rules. Here to talk about the changes is Angela Rose, Director of Health Information Management Practice Excellence at the American Health Information Management Association. We spoke recently, and I asked her to give us a little history about the HIPAA rules.
Well, the HIPAA privacy rule came into effect in 2003, was when organizations had to become compliant with it. And the HIPAA form that you're talking about is called the Notice of Privacy Practice. And what HIPAA did is it's a federal law that actually creates the floor, not the ceiling, of protecting patient health information. Individual state laws vary across the country, which can be more strict than what the federal law is. So the goal there with the federal law is to create the floor. And it also afforded patients more rights to their health information. So, for instance, under HIPAA, HIPAA granted them the right to view and, you know, obtain a copy of their health information. They have a right to request changes to their health information. They have a right to know who receives their health information and how it is used. They also have a right to request, you know, certain restrictions or limitations of the uses and releases of their health information. These are some of the rights that are afforded patients under the HIPAA privacy rules.
It's almost like they're treating health information like your credit report.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like your credit report, you have identity theft. With your health information, you do have medical identity theft as well, which is also, you see medical identity theft on the rise. And that's something that consumers should be very, very aware of.
And is that people just stealing somebody's health insurance plan and using their insurance for themselves?
Yes, that is. And the dangers there are if somebody steals your health information, for instance, or your health insurance information, and they go seek care under your name. Now, let's say they are severely ill, they could max out your lifetime health insurance benefits. That's one. Two, they could get treated under your name and get treated with medications that they might end up being allergic to or not allergic to that gets documented in your medical record. You show up to get treatment. And here it's not really your information. You get given a drug that you're really allergic to. So, I mean, ultimately, medical identity theft can be fatal.
And I imagine it, if you wanted to apply for health life insurance and they take a look at
that bogus
record, that's it for you.
Right. So the same way you would try and sort out, you know, identity theft for your credit card, you have to sort out your health information. Only that's, you know, more related to your own personal health and your own personal well-being.
What kind of restrictions were put on it initially? I know when I went to the doctor, I was asked, can we leave medical information on your answering machine, stuff like that.
Yes, and that was just that's again a part of HIPAA as a way of what information were you permitting to be used or not used, or, you know, let's say you were living with a roommate and you didn't want to know that you the results of your lab test put over your answering machine, which should not be done anyways. But they wanted to get permission to make sure, okay, we can remind you of a doctor's appointment on your answering machine. You know, that was just verifying that. HIPAA does allow for alternate communications, you know, alternate ways to contact you, you know, through a work phone number or a cell number versus your home number. So HIPAA, again, the ultimate goal there is protecting the patient's rights and their health information.
How many times have these rules, we'll say, evolved since they first went into effect?
The first time would be January 25th, 2013. So it's been 10 years, almost 10 years. HIPAA celebrates its 10th birthday. HIPAA privacy, let's remember. HIPAA is composed of composed of many sections, but as far as health information that we're talking about, privacy and security. Privacy became effective in 2003. The security portion became effective in 2005, and security added the protective measure for all electronic health information. So any of your health information in any electronic form or media protected under HIPAA. So January 25th, 2013, known as the high-tech rule, the final omnibus rule, adds the first changes. And I hate to say the word changes, because the one thing that I think people get confused about is organizations still have to be compliant with HIPAA. They just now have to be compliant with high-tech, too. So high-tech adds to HIPAA. So when I talk to our members or I talk to professionals, you know, remember, you still have to be compliant with HIPAA, but you have to be compliant with high-tech, too. And yes, high-tech does come out and make some changes to HIPAA, but it strengthens it and adds more privacy rights for patients.
I see one of the provisions similar to your credit report. You can now ask for an electronic copy of your health report.
Yes, you can. You have the right to walk in and say, you know, please provide me with an electronic copy. And also you will have the right to direct your health information to a third party if you so wish to do so.
What are some of the other new things that are going into the HIPAA regulations, the high-tech HIPAA regulation?
Well, some of the other new things would be the request for restrictions. So under HIPAA, a patient has the right to request restrictions on certain information, you know, like they don't want their information to be released any further. Under HIPAA, though, the covered entity or the organization has the right to decide, make the final decision whether or not they can honor that request. Under the high-tech final rule, or the omnibus rule, if a patient pays for a service or a treatment upfront, in full, out of pocket, and requests the restriction from their health plan, the organization has to restrict that piece of information from their health plan. So, for instance, you want to present and you want to get an HIV test, but you want to pay for it completely upfront, out of pocket, in full, to your provider. And you say to them, I don't want it going to my health insurance. They have to somehow flag it, tag it, make sure all their staff knows that that never, ever gets released to your health insurance plan.
There's also a new regulation that prohibits the sale of personal health information without authorization. Now, was this something that has been going on?
Well, the sale of PHI is a little bit, you know, under the final rule, it's just saying that the sale of PHI requires now authorization from every patient. Now, this doesn't include, for instance, a physician practice is, you know, sold to another physician practice. That does not apply in this case.
And one other thing, and I think this is very important going on with the way medical research and medical science is going on, is your genetic information is going to remain private and can't be used for insurance underwriting purposes.
Correct. That is correct. It cannot be used against you for underwriting purposes.
So is this it? Is HIPAA closed now? There'll never be another change, or do you see something coming up in another, say, 5 or 10 years?
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I think as we evolve with technology, and I think as our information becomes more electronic, I think protecting the health information of patients, consumers, will remain at the forefront. So do I think it can change again? Absolutely, because technology is consistently changing.
Angela Rose is Director of Health Information Management Practice Excellence at the American Health Information Management Association.
There may be a lot of new people filling out HIPAA forms soon. The state of New Mexico has one of the largest Native American populations in the nation, with over 200,000 registered tribal members. It's estimated that nearly 40% of those members do not have health insurance. Recently, New Mexico announced it will build a state-run health care exchange under the Affordable Care Act. However, the state has yet to decide whether to expand Medicaid, which could mean a lot of tribal members would suddenly have access to affordable health care. Tristan Atone reports.
At the age of 30, Taos Pueblo tribal member Eric Lujan began experiencing medical problems.
I was working nights at a casino. My leg was sore for a week, and then one day I was okay, and the next day my leg was twice the size, and I was going to the emergency room.
Several ER visits and a number of pulmonary embolisms later, Lujan had to quit his job, causing him to lose his health insurance. He also learned what was causing his health problems. His blood lacks the ability to dissolve clots, often causing unbearable pain, which can prevent him from working or even walking. To make matters worse, Lujan isn't able to use the Indian Health Service or IHS.
I am ineligible to use IHS facilities here in Albuquerque because I am an enrolled member of Taos Pueblo. If I wanted to access IHS services, I would have to go back to Taos Pueblo.
That's about 130 miles from his home in Albuquerque. In 2010, the Social Security Administration approved Lujan for disability payments, but that money left him ineligible for Medicaid.
I don't qualify for Medicaid because of my Social Security disability income is $10 over the federal poverty level limit for my circumstances.
If you're a family of four in New Mexico, the adults will not be eligible for Medicaid unless their earnings are below about $7,500 per year.
That's Kim Posich, director of the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty.
Under expansion, a family of four, you can earn up to about $32,000 a year, and the adults will be covered by Medicaid.
What makes this issue unique to Indian Country is that Native people essentially carry dual citizenship. In terms of healthcare access, that means the Indian Health Service is available to those living on their nations, and programs like Medicaid are available to those living away from their communities, like Eric Lujan. According to former Cochiti Pueblo Governor Regis Pecos, under Medicaid expansion, Native people would be able to utilize both services.
One of the things that is a particular threat here is that without the proposed expansion here in the state, without the safety net of this Medicaid program, it would cut out as many as 25,000 Indian people.
That's 25,000 Native people that would not be eligible for Medicaid. And for Pecos, that makes Medicaid expansion absolutely critical. New Mexico has announced that it will build a state-run healthcare exchange under the healthcare law. However, there could be costs for Native people wanting to join the exchange, which could be considerably high. That's according to Roxanne Spruce Bly, a member of the state's American Indian Health Advisory Committee.
If insurance isn't truly affordable, I don't know how likely it is that Indian people would acquire coverage through an exchange.
In other words, if Native people can't afford to pay health care exchange premiums and Medicaid doesn't expand in New Mexico, then many Native people in the state could easily stay in the same tenuous health care situation they've occupied for centuries, along with over 400,000 other New Mexicans who currently lack health care coverage.
I think it's less a racial question than it is a question of class.
Again, Taos Pueblo tribal member and disabled worker Eric Lujan.
Yes, minorities typically are on these kinds of programs. Yes, we access these programs more on a greater level. But since the economy has been worse, I think more and more non-minorities have been forced to be on Medicaid because health insurance is expensive and everybody's looking for a way to cut corners these days.
Governor Susana Martinez hasn't said yet whether she'll expand the Medicaid program, and no federal deadline has been set for the state to make a decision. I'm Tristan Atone.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.